To read this. My name is James Forster. I'm a CI student. As a class project, my classmates and I are collecting the oral histories from those in Ventura County who are affected by the current economic recession. By signing the consent form that I provided earlier, you have agreed to participate in the research and or you have agreed the audio recording of this interview to be archived at the Broome Library. I would like to assure you that whenever you feel uncomfortable with the interview, you can take a break and decide to withdraw your participation from the interview.
Okay.
All right, so first thing first, just tell me a little bit about yourself. You know, where were you born? How did you end up out here? And, you know, what were your previous jobs before this?
Okay. Well, I was born in Pasadena, California, in January of 1984, and we were living, my family was living in Covina at the time, and that's where I grew up, spent my entire childhood in Covina, and, you know, growing up, I didn't really think we were rich or poor. My parents divorced when I was six, so I kind of had a, you know, two-household situation there for my entire childhood. But looking back on that, I would say that we were probably middle to lower middle class growing up. You know, we never struggled too much, but perhaps that was because of, you know, maybe my parents hit it well. I mean, we weren't rich, but we weren't, you know, poor either. So, and yeah, you know, played sports all throughout childhood, and, you know, didn't really take school too seriously because it was easy, you know, especially elementary school and middle school. I don't remember ever worrying or stressing about school, really even through high school. And so, you know, probably because of that, my SAT scores were never that great, and my GPA in high school was good, but it wasn't great, and so, you know, I never really took the idea of going to college too seriously. It was something I thought I would do, but I never really, you know, when I was 16, 17, you know, 15, 16, 17, when you're supposed to be sort of worrying about college, I wasn't. So that's probably why I ended up at Citrus College, which is a community college in Azusa, and got my AA in English there, and then I transferred to CSUCI after that, and that's kind of how I came to be in the area originally.
And so you've kind of just been here and you've loved it ever since?
Yeah, so, you know, the first time I stepped foot on the campus, I just fell in love with it, you know, and it was small enough to where I felt like I could have personalized attention, you know, as far as my education is concerned. I didn't want to go to these bigger schools like Cal State Fullerton or Cal Poly Pomona, where you're just, you know, you're just kind of a number.
Yeah, this school kind of like fit your background the most.
It did, and I felt like because it was new, you know, I really cherished the idea of being a part of something at the beginning, you know, mm-hmm. growing with it.
What year did you come here?
I came here in the fall of 2005.
Okay, so it'd only been open for like 3 years.
Yeah, there'd only been, yeah, and I believe if this is, yeah, like 3 or 4 years. And so, you know, I was, I think the second year of that they had the Anacapa Village mm-hmm. dorms. So, you know, apparently the first year was really fun and the second year they cracked down on it. So, you know, the people who had lived there the year before, they're like, yeah, you should have been here last year. It was all, you know, it was anarchy. And so, yeah, I arrived in 2005, graduated in 2007 with my BA in English, and left the area to move to South Korea. That's where I taught English there for a year and a half. After Korea, I moved up to Humboldt to get my master's and teach composition and rhetoric, which I currently teach here. So yeah, I kind of did Korea for a year and a half, Humboldt for 2 years, and then I came back, did the whole kind of the boomerang.
That's pretty cool. Tell me about, like, your family and whatnot. So you said, like, mom, dad, you have brothers and sisters, you know.
Yeah.
How old are they?
Yeah, so I have an older sister. Okay. Her name's Kelly, and she is, I think, 3.5 years older than me. 3 to 3.5 years older than me. And she's very tough, you know, very, very independent woman. She made some life decisions early in life that kind of set up the trajectory of her life. She got pregnant at 14, had my nephew at 15. And so that obviously kind of put her on a different life path than most teenagers. And she still is, you know, kind of, her life is sort of a result of that whole process. I mean, you know, my nephew Shane is, you know, 16 now, and it's just crazy to think, like, you know, he's such a part of the family now that, you know, it's just, it's weird to think, like, if that whole episode didn't happen, you know, like, where her life would be, and, you know, just her relationship with our family, like, it just, everything kind of changed when that happened.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I mean, and I think that, you know, she was always kind of tough and independent and, you know, kind of stubborn before that, but that sort of reinforced all of those qualities in her, because she had to sort of, you know, to knuckle up and really be a provider and to be, you know, and to be a good mother, but also, you know, kind of like, I'm a teenager, or I'm still a young woman, and mm-hmm. I see all my friends kind of doing things that I can't do because of this. So, you know, it's been an interesting process. She got married and had my niece 2 years ago. So, and that's kind of, it's interesting now that we're all a little bit older, because, you know, being an uncle, you know, I became an uncle when I was like 12 or 13. And so I didn't really know what that meant at the time. But now, you know, to kind of see, you know, them, like, you know, to see my niece kind of growing up, it's cool. It's cool. And I think it changes, you know, the way that it changed the way I see my nephew too, even though he's way older. It's like, oh, I guess I didn't really know what I was doing, you know, mm-hmm. as far as an uncle is concerned with you. But now that I see Riley, it's like, I can kind of.
So with age, you've gained.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and I think, you know, like my sister, it's just, I don't think a 13, 14, 15 year old is prepared to be an uncle. Like, what am I supposed to do here? Or, you know, is this like a, right. like a big brother type thing? Or, so that's kind of my sister's situation. My brother is younger than me. He is a couple years younger than me. And he and I were always really close growing up. Because of the divorce, you know, we sort of went back and forth with each other to the houses of my sister, again, because of her situation, she was kind of always doing her own thing.
Yeah.
So my brother and I, you know, we became really close, you know, played sports, played video games, you know, shared a room for years. And so, you know, and even still to this day, we have this close connection. We've definitely grown apart, I think, because he is more of a homebody. He hasn't really ventured out too much from Covina. And I was always the kind of
born to get out of here
black sheep, you know, want to see the world type of son. So, and that, you know, that affected our relationship, because there's just, you know, I wasn't there, and, you know, he was doing his thing and I was living my life somewhere else. And so, we're still pretty close, but, it's just, as we get older, you know, the dynamic of relationships changes. Yeah. It's a natural occurrence. So, but yeah, I mean, he's, you know, he has his master's in marriage and family therapy, and he's working for a family therapy agency down in Long Beach. And so, you know, he's, yeah, it's just, you know, he's the baby of the family. So it's, you know, he takes things, he's way more serious. And I don't know, there's like this whole like kind of birth order theories where, you know, the oldest does this and like the middle does this and the youngest does that. And it'd be interesting to see.
I've thought about this before.
How that applies to, like, you know, us. Are you, you're
a... I have one older sister. And so my theories was like the oldest, usually like the smarter, you know, mm-hmm. usually try like hardcore. And then as it gets younger, it's, you know, don't care much about schooling and just things like that. And then eventually it all starts to click eventually.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, I mean, I think there's probably things that, that they can probably, you know, if you look at kind of the birth order books or whatever, I mean, I'm sure there's
some
things that, that can be applied to us and things that don't. So
Getting back on topic, what has like the recent economic recession that's been happening for the past like 10 years, what has it been like for you, your family, your friends? Is there anyone like in particular who has like really lost a lot, or what has it been like?
You know, I think just the general day-to-day expenses, I think that's where I've seen it the most. I mean, obviously trying to go to school during the, you know, the economic crisis was difficult. I mean, I was finishing up here at CI right around the time that the tuition increases were really kind of ratcheting up. And so I think that, you know, on a national level, you know, I didn't really see too many people that were affected by the housing bubble or, you know, the stock market or anything like that. But I think just in the local kind of state level, I saw, you know, a lot of people struggling to pay for school. Yeah, and like I said, just the general cost of living, you know, when gasoline goes up and groceries go up and, you know, it's just, it's expensive just to kind of, to get by. That's kind of where I saw it. You know, I think that, I was in Korea in, you know, pretty much all of 2009 and half of 2010, and that was a really bad year for the CSU system. That's, you know, when the furloughs kind of started, and, you know, one of my colleagues was let go and then eventually brought back, but it was just, it was a scary time for students and educators alike. So I think that's, you know, that's kind of where I've noticed the biggest kind of impact, and obviously I'm biased, you know, because of my profession, but, you know, I think that, you know, it's, perhaps I just wasn't really paying attention all that much, you know, to the other things, and again, I mean, I think that, you know, you sort of look to your family, and you kind of, all right, are we affected? I mean, I didn't know anybody that lost a house, I didn't know anybody that lost a job because of the recession,
right?
But, you know, in my family, I guess, but again, it was sort of more of a peripheral, like people struggling to pay for school, people struggling to, you know, pay for groceries and things like that.
Yeah, I definitely see that even with my experiences, and I know I'm much younger than you, but still things like that where it's just, I'm oblivious to obviously the negative things, but from what I can see, it's, you know, things like that that are the hard parts.
Yeah.
So I definitely understand that. Do you think, because of, you know, all of these things, you know, whether it's your health or housing or food insecurity, like with you or even your family, has, do you think like your life has changed much because of the economy, or would you say the last 10 years have kind of just been like a little downpour and not really that big of a deal?
Well, you know, it's tough to answer for my family. I mean, I think that we're all pretty privileged to kind of be where we're at. I don't think we've struggled as much as other families overall. I mean, I think
could have been worse.
It could have been a lot worse. And I think just, you know, I think it's just a little creature comfort type things that, you know, oh, we can't go on this second vacation, or, oh, we can't, you know, do this. You know, so I think that, you know, that's kind of where I think we've encountered it the most. But as far as like, you know, my health or anything like that, I mean, you know, thankfully we haven't, there hasn't been any major illness in our family. You know, and again, we haven't really, I'm sure we were affected, but it wasn't like a you know, a layoff or a foreclosure type of situation.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
Are you're pretty well up to date on like the whole economic recession. Like, you know, I'm assuming you know a lot about it just based on your position. Would there be anything like you would necessarily blame for it? Would you blame like just the economy in general, just certain government, you know, is there anything like, what do you think?
You know, I think, I mean, I would say obviously the whole kind of the lending spree that these banks got into, you know, giving people, you know, these interest rates that they couldn't afford. So I think there is this sort of sense of entitlement that I think most Americans have, that I need this size house, or, you know, I'm entitled to whatever. And so I think that, you know, the kind of greed of the market, I don't necessarily expect, you know, the market to ever really have a conscience. So kind of the capitalist kind of model of just keep expand until you explode or eat yourself to death. And that's sort of what we see with these bubbles. And that's what the housing bubble was. And that's kind of what it dragged kind of the rest of it down. And we still kind of see some of the residual effects going on across the world, and even, you know, here in America. I mean, it's and so we're so, all of these kind of international economies are so intertwined now that,
when one falls.
Yeah. And so we're all kind of, you know, we're like ships, you know, in a bay, kind of all tied together. And if one ship kind of sinks, then it's going to, you know, drag the others down with it as well. So, I think it was people's kind of sense of entitlement. I think it was irresponsible from on both ends of it. And I don't think that the government did enough to ensure that, the banks were being responsible.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the time came to, you know, to bail them out, or, you know, to have a reckoning, I think that, you know, the banks were definitely let off the hook.
Right.
Yeah.
Going back to that idea that you had, kind of the whole manifest destiny, kind mm-hmm. of what you were going at,
mm-hmm.
What do you think of, like, the American dream today? Like, a lot of people say the American dream is dead. It's been mm-hmm. dead for a while.
Mm-hmm.
What is your personal opinion on that? Do you think it's possible to come to this country with an American dream and fulfill what it is? Or do you think it's kind of an old age thing?
I think it's both. And I think that it is dead in some respects, in that it never really was what it purported to be. There's always been, you know, there's always been opportunities here. But if you look kind of historically, it was, well, if you were a white male, there's mm-hmm. opportunities.
So it's kind of all
if you own land. Yeah. So, I mean, and it's always been kind of a very select few. So, you know, with the economic inequalities in this country, it's becoming increasingly more difficult to kind of climb that ladder. You come to this country with nothing but, you know, a strong work ethic and the clothes on your back. I don't think it's impossible for you to make something of yourself, but it certainly is extremely difficult. So, you know, I think that it's more of the American illusion as opposed to the American dream. And sort of, you know, our grandparents' generation, you know, there's this kind of, like, if you pull yourself up by your own bootstraps and, you know, you work hard, and there'll be something there for you. Well, that's not the case anymore. It's just, you have to have some connections, and you have to get lucky to a certain extent.
Mm-hmm.
And with an unsustainable system that we have here, an unsustainable economic system, there's no way to ensure that everybody will have the same opportunities. I think that's not true. I think that's a fantasy.
Almost impossible.
Yeah, it is. And again, I mean, it's not impossible. It's not, you know, mathematically impossible for somebody to come here and, you know, like, okay, I opened up a convenience store, or I open up this fruit stand, or I open up a small business of, you know, something else, you know, and you can make it work. But I think that the likelihood of that happening is small.
It's kind of like American capitalism, like, there has to be people on the bottom for it to work.
Right, yeah, I mean, and I think that, you know, as, like I said, you know, the inequality of wealth distribution, it's fewer and fewer people own more and more of the wealth.
99%.
Yeah, and, you know, and that's sort of what, the whole Occupy movement was about, was, you know, sort of this kind of some people saw it as a redistribution of wealth. Others just wanted to kind of say, you know, I think some people need to be held accountable. And so, you know, it makes it difficult for the American dream to become a reality when things like the housing bubble kind of happens and people aren't held accountable that need to be held accountable.
Makes sense. Going back to the question that I asked you earlier, kind of about like health and whatnot, mm-hmm. would you believe, or do you possibly believe that it's possible that the economy in a way is making us like fat as like an American society based off of, well, I'm kind of going back to the whole advertising thing that we covered mm-hmm. in your class, you know, mm-hmm. cheap foods or salty foods or cravings that you have, like, is there's articles saying that salty foods, or like when you hear bad news about the economy, that's what you crave. Mm-hmm. So do you believe that these types of media advertisements or actual these companies are making America fat and therefore hurting us, our health-wise, and this is also hurting the economy?
Well, yeah, I think, you know, you can look at a number of different studies that have linked obesity rates with income. And so if you only have, you know, $20 or $30 to feed your family with per week, well, are you going to go and, you know, buy groceries with that? Or, you know, $23 doesn't go very far at the grocery store, but $23 can go pretty far at McDonald's. You go through the value menu. So I think that, yeah, getting the most for as little input, that is sort of what has become the driving force behind the American economy and just the American way of looking at consumption. It is kind of a, you know, value, this idea of value that I have, you know, I have X amount to spend. How can I get the most? Mm-hmm. Not quality, but quantity.
Right.
And so it is a quality versus quantity issue, absolutely.
And do you think it's, if the economy, like if the economic downfall would have never happened, do you think that, you know, obesity rates wouldn't be as high as they are today, or do you think that's kind of just been an American?
Perhaps it's tough to say. I mean, again, if you look at the correlation between, you know, economic disparity and obesity rates, you know, I think that you might kind of draw that conclusion. But you know, there's tons of fat rich people,
right?
So it's not,
because I mean, in the olden days, and I'm talking really before, yeah. right, like being fat was like a sign of wealth, and that was a
right.
good thing,
right?
But for some reason,
right.
now it's obviously the other way around.
Right. I mean, I don't think, I wouldn't encourage anyone to be fat.
Right.
And I don't think that's where you
no.
were saying either. But I think, you know, there's obviously more factors that contribute to it, a sedentary lifestyle, you know. But I think that if you look at the caloric intake of people and they have to survive, well, it's, you know, I can spend, you know, $3 or $4 on the value menu today, and that's what I eat.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just not viable to get all of the, you know, nutritional intake that you need from $3 or $4 a day. So it's difficult. It's difficult to, you know, perishable items like fruits and vegetables, that costs money, and they go bad. And
right.
so, you know, you got to go to the store every day, and it's just, there's a whole list of things that contribute to it. But I think to answer your question, I think that, you know, there is a direct correlation between wealth inequality and obesity. And I think that, you know, had the economic recession not taken place, perhaps there'd be a slightly better rate of obesity in this country.
But not by much?
I don't think, you know, I don't think by much, because I think there's a lot of factors that go into it. And so, you know, it's just that by itself, I don't think would influence it that greatly. That's just my opinion.
I do agree with you. I mm-hmm. do think that this country was headed down this obesity road
mm-hmm.
long before the economic recession
yeah.
took place, but it still affects it as well.
Yeah.
What would your be, kind of just getting to the end of this here, what would be your hope for, you know, the future when it comes to either you or like this country, or, you know, what would be your best hope?
When I think of the ideal America, I think of it as living up to its potential and not being not being hypocritical or exclusionary. And that's sort of how it purports itself. You know, give us your huddled masses. You know, the idea of, you know, sailing from whatever the old country is, you know, whatever problems you had going on there, and then you sail into Ellis Island and you see, you know, the Statue of Liberty, and it's like, all right, I'm gonna make something myself here. I ideally, you know, I would like to see a little bit more done on social services. I'm a little bit more liberal leaning in that regards. You know, I don't think it's a bad idea to have, you know, public health care. I think that you look at the countries that do it well, and they're, you know, it's not a drain on their economy. You know, it helps. It's for the greater good. You know, I think for the California and for the CSU system, I'd like to see a continued increase in investment from the state. I think that, you know, the last few years we've gotten away from that, hopefully with this new chancellor, and it seems that Jerry Brown seems to be kind of on board with getting the CSU back to where it was intended to be.
Right.
So it's like, you know, I kind of see, you know, there's the ideal of what we think this should be, of what we're saying that this should be, and then there's the day-to-day reality.
Of what actually happens.
Yeah, so what actually happens. So, you know, the problems for the country are going to, I believe, get worse as long as a small percentage of the population owns a large majority of the wealth. And that's just, you know, that's, you look at any kind of historical situation and that's where societies collapse in on themselves. So if that trend continues, I don't think it's a very positive outlook for the nation. And perhaps, you know, it may need to kind of bottom out, and then there may have to be some sort of drastic social, you know, revolution that needs to take place for that to kind of figure itself out totally. But I hope it doesn't come to that.
Right.
But, you know, the upper class, you know, money pulls the strings. So
it's all about the money.
Yeah, and it's, I think as long as we cater to the rich and kind of look at the poor as, you know, leeches off the system, I think that continued perspective will not bode well for this country.
That makes a lot of sense. Is there anything else that you would like to add overall in general?
No, I mean, I, you know, as a product of the CSU system, I feel like it's, you know, it's a fantastic service. I'm happy to be an alum. I'm proud to be a current faculty member of it. And I hope to continue to see it grow and flourish and, you know, serve the state in the way that it was meant to. And be viewed as a public good, and to not be, again, sort of viewed as this just drain on the economy.
Right.
So yeah, that's, I just...
Teachers don't get obviously a lot of respect, but...
We don't. I mean, and it's, and that's not, I'm okay with that. I don't, you know, that doesn't... It doesn't weigh on me, you know, from day to day, but it's just, it's where you're at, you know, because again, I've been where you've been, and so that's where, the position I'm in now, I mean, how many students are going to be priced out of education if we continue to kind of, you know, to put more and more of the burden on the students? We'll just take out more student loans. Well, that bubble's going to burst soon,
right?
Pretty, you know, I mean, and so it's all about priorities and perspective, and I think that, you know, if we don't have our priorities in the right places, then things will continue to be problematic.
Well said. All right, that concludes my interview. I don't have anything else to say.
Okay.
Thank you
for
everything. There's a lot of useful information here.
Okay.
So,
Yeah, my pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Yeah,
I'll see you in class.
All right.